And I estimated it to be about, oh, the size of a basketball held at arm's length when it finally shrank down to as small as it got. Very, very intense. And the light winked out. And Williamson, still entranced, said, "Did you note the location of where the light went out?" Not one of us could have told you where on the face of the cliff that light had gone out. We were so interested in watching what the light was doing, none of us thought to try and figure out where, at what, on what part of the cliff it had finally blinked out. They said, "Watch, we'll do it again." I'll tell you, our friends certainly have a tremendous amount of patience. This, I think, you'll have to admit. Either that or we're very dense. The whole thing happened again. The cliffs lit up very quickly again, starting off with a very pale glow, building up brighter, again just like an X-ray, as if the light was coming from within and behind the rocks and shining out, because you could see all the cracks in the rocks. And we watched it this time when it went through the whole business of shrinking in from the ends into this ball of light, and we were watching for landmarks on the top of the cliff, you know, little outcroppings or saddles and things like this, so we could pinpoint it. And it happened again. The light winked out. This time we had a pretty good idea where it was on the face of the cliff. Would you believe we asked him to do it one more time? We really did. We had gall, I'll tell you. We did. They went through it one more time for us. Did the whole same thing again, and I mean, we really wanted to make sure we knew where that light had finally disappeared. And Williamson's standing behind us, because we're all standing between him and the cliffs now. He's being totally ignored, except for a comment every now and then out of him. And, you know, he probably turned to a block of ice sitting back there, and we didn't recognize him at all. We really saw the spot and got it fixed in our mind. And then he finally said, "Are you satisfied?" And we said, "Yes, we're satisfied." "Why did you want us to mark the location?" He said, "Tomorrow, go there and look." Fine. That's all for tonight. That's all for tonight. We were very thankful. Okay, before we left, we went back across the creek from the meadow because we wanted to be super sure we weren't being fooled. We searched all along the base of that cliff with flashlights and everything else, looking for concealed spotlights, anything that could have caused that type of an occurrence. First, we knew that it really wasn't that, but we wanted to satisfy our own curiosity. There weren't any hidden lights. This had not been something prearranged. So we searched all along the base of the cliffs. Couldn't find a thing. There was nothing out behind us except miles of nothingness. So the lights couldn't have come from back there, or you'd have seen the beam of lights going by us. Okay, we were satisfied there were no hidden lights, and nobody was out playing pranks on us that night. So we all went home, thawed out in a local coffee shop again, nearby town, and then drove all the way back to Prescott. We went back the next day, drove all the way back again, went there in the daytime, went the hard way, we found, the first time, almost fell in the creek from 300 feet up. So we got smart after that. We went around and came in the other way and found out we could almost walk right into the place. And when we got to this place, we found an opening in the cliff. A tunnel. It was a bricked-up room. The entranceway was bricked up with adobe bricks, but there was an interesting opening. The opening was like a T upside down. That was the shape of the opening, just like the letter T turned upside down. The opening wasn't any bigger than that. And when we got inside of this walled-up thing on the face of this cliff, hanging out in the middle of nowhere, we were in a room. The room had been hollowed out, obviously. Whether by Indians, who knows, but the room was hollowed out. Okay, we checked the room out. The room had a very high radiation count, much higher than normal. Now, this particular rock that we were in was a sedimentary deposit. Sedimentary deposits are not normally radioactive. This room was hot, not hot enough to be dangerous, but well above the background, at least 40, 50 points high. Okay, we stamped around on the floor because we figured there's got to be something in this room besides this hollow room. The floor sounds hollow. You know how a hollow floor sounds when you stamp on it? The floor sounded hollow. But fine. Just so happened we brought along some picks and some GI shovels. So we got down on our hands and knees because the ceiling was low. The ceiling couldn't have been more than 5 feet, 5.5 feet. And the only way you could swing a pickaxe was to get down on your hands and knees, you know, to get enough upward to pull down with it. And we dug a hole. We worked for a couple of hours, got filthy, and dug a hole a foot deep, about a foot wide, because we found out it's pretty laborious using a pickaxe on your hands and knees. The trench shovel didn't work any better. We finally decided the only way we'd ever dig down through this hollow floor, if it was deeper than a foot, was either with a jackhammer or dynamite. And we didn't think that either one of them would do any good, to be honest with you. So we're getting a little discouraged now with the whole thing. We'd come all this way from Michigan out there and found this beautiful, neat little room and saw the lights were worth it. That was the whole trip, was worth the lights. And we found a neat little room, and this was great. So we said, okay, fellas, I mean, this is all we're going to get, you know, a light show and a neat little room. And the fun of digging a hole in the ground, in the room. And they said, no. You will come back to this place many, many times. Great. When? You'll be back within 6 months. Well, that didn't agree with our plans. And they said, you'll be back many times in the coming years to this spot. And we said, why? They said, every time you will bring someone new with you. Why? He said, because the activating mechanism that will open this repository is keyed to the vibrations of certain people. When their vibrations are recorded at this spot, it's like another tumbler in the lock falling into place. And when the right people have presented themselves, the activating mechanism will start to open this repository. But this is not the end of the story. It sounds like the end. We left Arizona. We went to California. We've been back many times to that place, and every time with different people. Things have changed there, naturally. This room has been vandalized several times now. We don't know by whom. But what was there originally is not there now. So we found out a great deal more about this place. This place, or this little room, that the ball of light finally condensed around or over to indicate where its location was to us, is a secondary entrance to this repository. Our space friends pointed out where the main entrance was, 200 feet down the cliff. The main entrance is at least 100 feet wide and 200 feet high. And they said part of it has been activated by your presence. We've been back there every year. That 100 foot by 200 foot section of cliff is moving away from the rest of the cliff. Eventually, it's going to fall into the stream. There must be one heck of an opening behind it. But it has got the government worried. They're sending people out to study this weird erosion, they call it. But here's a section of cliff 100 feet by 200 feet high, moving away by some unknown means from the rest of the cliff. What's inside this cliff? A ramp, we've been told. It goes down 300 feet underground. And there's a room down there, a huge room. This room is at least a good square mile in size. We've asked them many, many times to describe the contents of the room. And they've told us that there is equipment that's stacked in aisles, bays, etc. And some of the neat things that are there are some UFOs, some aircraft, very advanced aircraft, like the Atlanteans had. There are all types of machines, instruments, you name them, power generators, the whole bit. Scientific equipment, the whole, and also the 12 cylinders, each containing 144 tablets, of which one is missing, the ones the Apaches had. So one cylinder is short, it only has 143 tablets in it. This too was confirmed by the space friends. By the way, the last time we were there, the Apaches still hadn't gotten back. So, they didn't seem a bit worried. They knew it would come back. It had disappeared before and always turned up again. So we found a lot of interesting things. We found the Indian legends confirmed what the space people had told us about the place. The place was there, and of course none of us knew about it. The phenomena of seeing the cliffs light up blew our minds, particularly when it happened three times in a row. The room was there, right where the ball of light had disappeared. The room had a hollow floor. They described it later as a secondary entrance. If we'd have dug down a few more feet, we'd have actually broken into a shaft, which would have let us down into this room underneath. Okay. We said, well, how about if we go back and dig it deeper? They said, the time's not right. Well, when will it be right? Before very long. We came to California, as I said, after we left Arizona. We stopped one other place, a place called Rogers Dry Lake, which is, I guess we just have to say, somewhere between Needles and Blythe, not very far from the Colorado River, in California. That's pretty desert country down there. Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back after the break, we'll finish the story and we'll tell you about some of the other things along this very same nature that are here in California. And also about, remember the one we skipped in New Mexico? We'll go back and give you the finish of the story on that one. Okay, we'll take a break now. Okay. Let's go back to the New Mexico area for just a moment. We found out something about the place in New Mexico quite by accident. My wife and I, while we were in Arizona, both of us joined the Civil Air Patrol. Any of you ever heard of that? And we flew a lot of search and rescue missions over in that area, up in the mountains. So, of course, we came into possession of aeronautical charts and things like this, which were part of any pilot's equipment. On these charts, we came across some interesting things. We decided one day we were going to look up that area that we had been told about in New Mexico. And strangely enough, on the aeronautical chart is this particular area and the little side road that they told us to remember. This little side road is now a highway with a route number on it. And within 5 miles of this, taking this little road down a ways, is a severe magnetic disturbance. It's marked on the aeronautical charts. In fact, there's a heavy warning written on the aeronautical charts. Severe magnetic disturbance 4,000 feet above ground. Ground at that level is about 6,500 feet. So from 6,500 feet, another 4,000 feet straight up over this area exists a severe magnetic disturbance. Usually magnetic disturbances are not this sharply defined, and they don't just quit like our radio signal did. In other words, the disturbance doesn't exist 4,000 feet over the terrain at that point. Only up to 4,000 feet, then it's not there. Magnetic fields don't behave this way either, and yet here it is marked on a Federal Aviation Agency chart. And nobody ever questioned it. Why? You know, they just don't disappear. Why it would extend 4,000 feet above ground at that elevation, no one knows. We know that particular spot is a navigational pivot point for our UFO friends, because exactly due north of that location is Aztec, New Mexico. Any of you remember what happened at Aztec in Farmington, New Mexico? The big UFO flap in 1952? Exactly 30 miles due north. Due south, the White Sands Proving Grounds. Does that suggest anything to anybody? Due west, it passes within a few miles of the location we're talking about in Arizona. You follow that degree of latitude. Due east, also, if you extend the line, you find a lot of sightings have taken place. So, in other words, this magnetic disturbance in New Mexico is a navigational beacon that our space friends use, and they call it a pivot point. In other words, it's apparently where some grids intersect one another in their navigational systems. And they fly through that area, and when they reach this disturbance, they make a turn. They can change direction. So, these are some of the interesting things. But what about the things that we found? We were also told by our space friends that another repository exists in California at Mount Shasta. Now that was very interesting, because in my very early days I had read about Mount Shasta being the so-called one of the locations of the Great White Brotherhood. And of course some of you are familiar with a book, A Dweller on Two Planets, written by Philos, in which they describe some very interesting things that exist at Mount Shasta. We had no connection that Mount Shasta had anything to do with our space friends until they brought it up one time, very casually, and of course, you know, alarm bells went off and we started asking questions. And we found out that there is an installation in Mount Shasta. Now, as you can tell, I'm a curious breed myself, and I like to check things out. So, a few years ago, we went up to Mount Shasta, and we drove all the way around it, or as far around it as we could, and for some reason, we took an entire series of photographs of that mountain from every angle, or every angle we could get to with an automobile. And so we ended up with some beautiful pictures of Mount Shasta. Strange thing is that in one of the pictures, it shows where the opening is. We didn't know it when we were taking the pictures, but there it exists in the picture. So, there is an opening in Mount Shasta, and it's a very funny thing. There is a shaft of light in the picture pointing directly to the opening, and the opening is visible. Now, if any of you have taken pictures in the daylight hours with color film, and these are color slides I was taking. You don't normally see shafts of light in color pictures that point to specific things, and this one does. So we know where that one is, at least where the opening is. We have never been back up there, though, because we have never been informed to go back up there. Apparently, somebody else is concerned with that one. We are not. Maybe now that we're in California, we might be. So far, no word on that one. We still go back to visit the one in Arizona. Okay. Where else have our space friends mentioned? Well, of course, there have been many mentions around various places in Africa, South America, Central America, Tibet. A lady was asking me about the Gobi Desert. We understand there's something in the Gobi Desert, but we don't know exactly what it is. So we've had a lot of interesting locations, but these are all far enough away that we can't get to them easily. But there are others as well. Do you remember several talks ago we talked about the mysterious second moon of the Earth? Do you remember that? How many of you remember that? Good. The majority of you. And we said that we would have more to say about that mysterious second moon. One of the gentlemen here in the audience dug me up a clipping or a reference to the astronomer that I mentioned in that talk as being the fellow who discovered that second moon. And in the clipping that this gentleman provided me with came some other interesting information. We described this moon as being in orbit around the Earth, but a very highly elliptical orbit. We find now, from studying the article, that actually the orbit resembles something of a figure eight, and that both the gravity of the Earth and the gravity of Venus affect this moon, this second moon of the Earth. And it's literally making a figure eight around Venus and the Earth. Okay, it revisits the Earth every 8 years. It comes back close to the Earth every 8 years. And the funny part about it is that if it swings too close, they're not worried at all about a collision with the Earth. Because if it swings too close, it being so small, only a mile in diameter, that the Earth's field, as it swings close to the Earth, accelerates it. And of course, when it swings around the Earth then at an increased speed and flies off back out into space. So it's almost like it's being repelled every time it comes here, and we're just giving it another shot in the arm to send it back in its orbit. But its orbit is actually controlled by the gravitational fields of both Venus and the Earth. It's a very strange behaving moon, isn't it? Most moons don't do this. We think of them as just being in circular orbits. This one's flying an elliptical figure eight. Okay. We also said there was something unusual about the moon. We mentioned that the moon was put into space at the time of the evacuation of Atlantis by a joint effort of the Atlanteans and our space friends. In this moon are stored more artifacts for us on this planet. More things that will be useful to us, not only in some of the troubled times ahead, but also as we enter this new age. There is also a full-blown installation on our moon, our regular moon. And it too is on the surface of the moon, but it is invisible to our astronauts and to our satellites, because our space friends have a way of using what they call fields of force that can actually bend light rays around objects. Therefore, to look at the object or to photograph it, you'd see nothing. But it is really there. That's why they're not really too concerned about camouflage, except in that sense. They don't paint their installations, you know, to make it blend in with the moon rock. They just bend the rays of light around the object. Therefore, it's there, but it isn't there, unless you walk up and bump into it. That might be something, huh? Be out walking on the surface of the moon and bump your nose or stub your toe on something that isn't there, that you can't see. But you reach out, and, yep, it's there. Okay. That's how they can conceal. Also, they can conceal their own vehicles. If they wish to land a vehicle on this planet's surface and have that vehicle remain undetected as far as sight is concerned, have someone not see it, they can do the same thing. They can bend rays of light around the vehicle so that it just isn't there to our sight. Now, to a radar signal, it would still be there, but not to our eyes or to a camera. We also mentioned this evening that we were going to talk about the fact that our friends in space have been letting their presence be known for a long, long time. Two of the things that came to us as interesting pieces of information were what they call their galactic broadcasts. And we found out that they have a type of communication that one involves rays of light. And it's very interesting, if any of you have read your papers in the last 2 days, to realize how laser beams are going to be used as a method of conduiting power from one place to another. Our space friends have been doing this for a long time. They mention it in one of the tapes that we have. Okay, but what else? We asked them, again, many years ago, if there were any other broadcasting stations, literally in space, besides the one that they mentioned to us that exists on the planet Mars. And they said yes. And back in 1956, they said, we have a broadcast from two different stars in your locale. And we said, could you tell us what they are? And they said, yes, in your terminology, knowing what our words for them were. They said, one is called the star Gamma, G-A-M-M-A. It is in the constellation of Aries. The other is in the star system numbered M31. This is some kind of a indexing astronomers use. I don't know what it means. And it's called NGC 224 in the constellation of Pegasus. These two stars are constantly sending out what our space friends refer to as pulse code information. Pulse codes. I asked once before if many of you were pilots, or if you knew what Omni was to a pilot. Well, if you were listening to an Omni station as a pilot, you would notice a series of code pulses being sent. I think from what our space friends have indicated that these broadcasts are also pulse codes. Only they're far more than navigational beacons. They are actually sending out intelligent programming, broadcasts, but in pulse-coded form. Okay, we don't know whether our astronomers know about these or not. I've never had a chance to sit down and talk with a good astronomer as to whether he's familiar with either one of these things that they have mentioned here, or whether any one of them is known as a source of radio signals in the heavens. The ones that we have heard about are not these. In some books they mention radio stars and pulsars and things like this, but I've never yet found these two mentioned. So I don't know if these are new or not. We also said that we mentioned as well that we would be covering tonight some of the magic of the so-called mystery schools. Well, there are many, many mystery schools on this planet. And there have been down through time. The ones that our space friends have referred to particularly were mystery schools having to do with certainly Egypt, but much earlier than the Egypt that we think about. Egypt when it was known as the land of Khem, K-A-K-H-E-M, rather than Egypt. They talk about some of the things, the mystery schools, that the priesthood of more recent Egypt had back in the times of the pharaohs. But that appeared to be some type of a step down or degradation from the original teachings. They've mentioned Zarathustra or the Zoroastrian or Mazda mystery schools, of Uhura Mazda. They have also mentioned the Mithric rites that were underground in the time of Rome. They have also mentioned the Essenes. They have also mentioned the Oracle of Delphi. They have also mentioned the Druids and the Order of the Rosy Cross in Europe, which later I think became the Rosicrucians in this country. A lot of these things they have mentioned from time to time and made some comments regarding. Now, they're normally not lengthy comments, and maybe only a sentence or two or a short paragraph regarding them. But in combing back over the information, what we have found the gist of their references were is that much of their references to the legacy of man on this planet is contained in the literature of these various ones that we've mentioned. But there are references to it. They may be obscure, but they're there. So, in other words, sight has not been lost. Somewhere, there are people who know about these things. We are sure, as well, that we are not privileged, in any sense of the word, in knowing about a few of these locations ourselves. We're certain there are others who know of equally as valid locations, wherever they may be. For instance, we know that there is one on an island in the middle of the Mississippi River. On an island in the middle of the Mississippi River. What a strange place to put one. But there's one there. And I'm sure someone back in that area knows about it. Or someone there is doing the same thing we were led to do in Arizona and in parts of California, have knowledge of these locations and have checked them out. Know that there's something there. I don't know whether any of us have been privileged yet to actually enter one of these places. But from the detailed information that we've received as to what's in them, it leads us to believe, and plus the fact that at least the one in Arizona that we're very well acquainted with is in the process of opening. This huge slab I mentioned, 100 by 200 feet, is moving away, which means it's a doorway that is opening slowly. That what's in these places is somehow going to be useful to the people on this planet. Our space friends seem to be very, very knowledgeable about how this material was put into these places, who put it there, why it was put there, what it is to be used for. They have kind of been the watchdogs of it down through the centuries. They have enlisted the unknowing aid of the tribes and the Indians to also help protect these places. In several instances, even the United States government is unknowingly protecting some of these installations. You know, my friends, there is a time coming when you are all going to have an opportunity to see our brothers in space physically. It won't be a vision. They'll walk up to you and you'll walk up to them, you'll shake hands or some other form of greeting, you'll talk to them, they'll talk to you. It may be telepathically, it might not. It might be verbally, but you will communicate. You will know with whom you're talking. There'll be no doubt in your mind. You'll know that these people are exactly what they say they are. You'll sense it. They're not going to have to explain themselves to you, because you are going to know. You know, there's a difference when you know something versus when you have to learn something. Right? You've all heard the expression, you have a hunch, a feeling, you know. you will know these people. They will have a way of letting you bring your knowing into operation. Therefore, there's not going to be any misunderstandings. You're not going to hook up with the wrong crowd, because otherwise you won't know. These people will let you know. And they will rely on your knowingness to confirm who they are. And let's face it, if you don't buy it or buy them, do you suppose it's really going to disturb them? Really? It's going to be neat, isn't it, one of these days, meeting these people? We think that we live in an amazing age, don't we? We see going to the moon, we see radio, television, radar, you name it. And yet, my friends, we haven't seen anything yet. We haven't truly seen the stars. We haven't been to any of the other planets. We haven't met our fellow man out there amongst the stars. And there's some pretty neat ones. And by the way, some very neat ladies, too. They're not all males. So, you see, fellas, you've got something to look forward to, and gals, you've got something to look forward to. Who knows, we may start a whole new thing. Anyway, there are some interesting things coming about. And with the troubled times that this planet faces, there is going to be a need for some certainly informed people who know how to, who know what is going to occur, where it is going to occur, how it will occur, how the people will be affected, and then who can do something about it. Who can do something about it. I don't mean stop things from happening, but at least be able to assist those to whom it is happening. Do you get the distinction? To whom it is happening. There are great numbers of people on this world who are going to need all the help they can get. There are thousands of people on this planet today who, let us say, are ready to, in a sense, be activated the same as these repositories are being activated. Maybe there's a switch somewhere just waiting to be pushed, which will suddenly bring into your recollection who you are, really. Don't think of yourself as being a clodhopper, a dimwit, a lame brain, a stumblebum, or what have you. You may be something far different. Don't let the guise of the personality through which you're operating totally distort the fact that your true being could be something entirely different. You know, our space friends once said that our personalities are like a mask. We put them on as we come into each life, and we take them off when we depart. The mask has nothing whatever to do with our true being. It's just the personality that we have adopted to have a certain experience. So you see, regardless of how you think of yourself, you may be something completely different. One thing we can be pretty assured of, though, based on, again, information that we've received not only from our friends in space, but also from many of the great teachings on this planet. And that is this. Today, the great bulk of people who are on this planet, the Earth, are those who are here for a purpose. And the purpose isn't necessarily just to undergo another learning experience. The purpose could be to serve. to help. Think about that. There may be a learning experience coupled to it, but nonetheless, there are great numbers of people on this planet today who are here to help. When they become aware of who they are, then they will know what their function is, what their role is, or the role is that they've been playing. But they'll know then their true purpose. And really, isn't that the story behind everything each of you has wanted to know in your own heart deep down? Who am I? Where am I going? What am I going to do? How am I going to do it? And of course, we always qualify it with God's will, we'll know, right? Someday. The day is much closer than any of us think. It has been our privilege to stand up here and share these things with you. We are looking forward to it. Next time we speak with you on the 12th of June, we're going to be talking about something that I think you're going to find very interesting. We are going to delve rather deeply into more of the, let's say, the deeper esoteric thoughts of our friends in space. We've dealt a great deal so far in these talks with information, both phenomena and non-phenomena. We've tried to give you a little of their philosophy, but everyone is curious to know what are their deep thoughts about. So next time we're going to discuss that with you and share that with you. People always say, do they believe in Jesus? Or is there a Jesus on every planet? Etc. They have answers to those questions, and we'll be talking about them. Okay, I think we will collect the cards from you now at this time. And I would like to thank you very, very much for being such a marvelous audience again.